This is Bill Cimino, and I'm interviewing William Bill Crom on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. This interview is taking place September 5th, 2023, at the Amelia Island Museum of History in Fernandina Beach, Florida, as part of the Library of Congress Veterans History Project. Also present with me are Tina Taker, Yvette Ray, and Scott Sherman, all members of Cross the Line Foundation. Assisting me with the interview is Tina Taker, and she will be operating the recording equipment at this time. Now, I read your biography, and I know a lot of the biographical information in the biography gears towards the contracting works, but we're going to start a little bit further back than that. So,
okay. Ancient history.
So can you tell me a little bit about where you're from and what you did, what led you to joining the military?
Well, I was an Army brat. And my father was a World War II veteran. He was a UDT in World War II. And he got his combat infantry badge in Korea. And so I grew up with Vietnam on the TV screen, okay? So I don't know, he was my hero. So I wanted to follow in his footsteps. I wanted to do that. I'm not big on swimming. So I stayed away from the UDTs or the SEALs, and I went into Ranger Battalion when I was a young man. But I knew that's exactly what I wanted to do from my earliest memories.
Then what year was that?
84, I think, 84, 85.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about those first years in service prior to the contract work as far as units and things like that. Did you go straight to the Ranger Battalion, or were you in an infantry unit?
I was in a couple of infantry units as an officer in the Ranger Battalion. You can't just go in and take over a platoon. You have to have had one in a conventional unit first. Okay, so I was in Korea, 2nd ID, 2nd Infantry Division, and I had a platoon there, and you know, a couple other jobs. I loved it. I mean, you know, it was interesting there. We were doing ambush and recon patrols inside the DMZ at the time. I think we've given that mission up. But then I went back to Fort Benning, to 3rd Bat, and I spent about, 16, 18 months in Honduras, training indigenous soldiers, whatever, locals for in the same sorts of things, raids, ambushes, things like that. And then after that, you know, as I got promoted, I, you know, was promoted out of there, and I went to the 1st Cavalry Division, and I did the Gulf War with the 1st Cav. And I don't know, it seemed like the right thing to do at the time. You know, I got out after 10 years of active duty, and then became a stockbroker. And it was interesting for a while, but you know, it wasn't really my style. And then they started this war in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, I wasn't going to sit around and watch it on the TV, so I blasted out my resume to all the contracting companies that I knew that were doing business in Iraq. I signed on with the first one that said yes, and that was kind of a mistake, but you know, we didn't know what we didn't know at the time.
Did others from your military unit decide to go into the contracting business as well? Do you know any other Rangers that went?
Oh, absolutely.
Knew some of the guys that went when you went?
Right, yeah. There was one guy that was a sergeant major in the Ranger Battalion, and we did contracting work together in Baghdad for Triple Canopy, I think it was. Yeah, Triple Canopy.
Mention his name? Do you want to mention his name? Or is that something you can't do?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I haven't talked to any of these guys, so I don't know, you know, what they want me to say or not. You know, I don't think it's a big deal, but some people do. And those that are still working the contracts, yeah, I got to leave them some of the pictures that I have. You know, I'm not going to share those because those guys are still working the contracts.
And how many years did you do the contract work?
Total of 15. 15 years in and out of Iraq and Afghanistan.
And how much time did you spend in each, would you say? How much time in Iraq, how much time in Afghanistan?
Oh.
How did you split the time, or was it different security companies?
Yeah, it was. I worked several different contracts. Let's see, the first one in Iraq was Department of Defense. It was running guns, being convoy security, and we were running weapons and ammunition to the Iraqi Army. Then I worked a State Department contract there at the embassy in Baghdad for Triple Canopy. The first company was Custer Battles. That was a bad experience, okay? And then I went back with Triple Canopy, and that was an altogether better experience, you know, professional company and with a good mission. And we were providing security for, you know, everybody that worked in the embassy and all the visitors. The Codels were a big one, the congressional delegations, and we'd run them downtown, Baghdad, whatever. And that was going on in 2005, 2006, before the surge. After that, the next company I went to work for was a company called MVM. They had the CIA and NSA contracts, and those were interesting. For the CIA, I was a trainer for the guys like, you know, 13 hours at Benghazi. Those guys, they'd come through. We'd push them through a selection course, and then every year we'd do a requalification. And then after a few years of doing that, I went onto the program myself and to Afghanistan.
What was the qualification? What was the qualification like?
Well, it was no joke. We'd take 30 guys maybe to start in a class, in a selection class, and they had to have had 8 years of kicking indoors experience with some kind of special operations group, like, you know, Green Beret, SF. SEALs, Marine Recon, or Rangers. They also had to have worked with somebody that was already on the program, so they had to get a recommendation from somebody already on the program to even come to selection. We'd go through, I don't know, I think the selection was about a month and a half. It was no joke. Out of the 30 guys with this kind of experience, we'd take maybe four or five onto the program.
How many guys were on a contracting team or on a specific team? What was
different contracts called for different numbers. That first one I worked for on a team, there were four or five of us in a vehicle, per vehicle, and then maybe four gun trucks in total. And the contract called for 26 gun trucks, and quite frankly, they were only running about six. Called for 26 teams, and they were running about five or six teams. So they're taking the money and, you know, whisking it off to the Cayman Islands.
With the exception of the terrain, what would you say the biggest difference the work in Afghanistan versus the work in Iraq?
Well, let's see. I spent the first several years in Iraq, and the first, I don't know, three or four were pretty much out of control. And things had settled down a bit by the time I started going to Afghanistan. And in Afghanistan, things had already settled down quite a bit by the time I got there. So I don't know. It was to me, Iraq was far more dangerous than Afghanistan. But you know, that's relative to what I was doing. Also, I mean, we provided static security. You know, where people lived and worked. And mobile security, just getting them around, getting them to, you know, wherever they needed to go to get their business done, keep them alive, and then bring them back. In Afghanistan, early on, we couldn't hardly, or in Iraq, early on, you could hardly move down the streets without taking casualties. And in Afghanistan, we could travel all over the country, and you know, we might have one or two little incidents, but in Iraq. A lot of the times we were high profile too, so it was like we showed off our guns, get everybody out of the way. And in Afghanistan, it was low profile, and you wanted to blend in and be able to move.
It says here, okay, on presidential and congressional security duties. What? Give me a little elaboration on some of that.
Those were pretty interesting. I think I was on maybe three presidential security details over there. And I got a kick out of it because, you know, the Secret Service is, you know, they look cool. They've got their suits on and their sunglasses and, you know, very Hollywood. And when they got over to the war zone, though, they turned it all over to us. they'd stay with the president, you know, close in security, but we were the ones that got them, that moved them around and kept them safe. We knew the battlefield. And the Codells, any congressional delegation that came over, we'd take them where they needed to go, you know, the finance ministry in Baghdad, or, you know, whatever meet and greet they had to do.
I don't know if I'm leaving out anything or because I don't want to get into what 2016 when everything was over and you came home, what led you to leave or get out at that time? Just end of conflict and.
Well, my wife had done 27 years in the Army and she requested retirement, but they wouldn't let her go. I didn't realize that, you know, you have to request it and, you know, they may or may not let you go. It was another 3 years before she had gotten out of there. But she had spent 21 years at the Pentagon and the satellites up there in Northern Virginia. So she came down here to Fernandina Beach one weekend with a girlfriend of hers, and then she called me in Afghanistan and told me where we were going to go retire. I stopped what I was doing and I came down here with our daughter so she could start high school. And that was it for me. Yeah, I haven't gone back. I'd like to, but I haven't.
are there any stories that you're willing to share with us that really just stick out in your mind from Iraq and Afghanistan that just stand out and say, this is a, we'll go with good memories?
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe some good ones and some bad ones.
Good ones typically aren't that exciting, right? Yeah. I don't know. The memories that stick with me are the ones where, you know, things didn't go right for some reason, you know. Those are the ones I think about. We had the first company I was with was really, I mean, they lied to us in the States. They told us that we'd have state-of-the-art equipment, state-of-the-art communications. It was all personal security detail, PSD work, right? So that is, you take a client and you move them somewhere. You take them somewhere, let them take care of their business and bring them home. We'd have three American expats in a vehicle and one Iraqi driver. When I got there, it was convoy work, and it was like, you know, convoys, there are only so many hardball roads that you can travel up and down with a semi. There was one American driver, and the rest of the truck was loaded with Kurdish Peshmerga. The vehicles were not armored, and so everybody was scared, and it was like driving in a shooting gallery. We'd go from, let's see, our milk run was, our compound was at Bayop, at the Baghdad International Airport. And from there, we'd take four gun trucks and run over to Abu Ghraib, a suburb of Baghdad. There are these compounds, okay? We'd go into one of these compounds and pick up. It was a gunfight the whole way, okay? As soon as we left one compound, we'd get in a fight. And then we'd get to the next compound, and we'd pick up four gun trucks, and we'd escort them north up to Crit, to a place called Anaconda. We'd hook up trailers that were full of weapons and ammunition, and then run them down to Fallujah and turn them over to the Iraqi army. And, of course, the Battle of Fallujah was going on, and it was pretty crazy. You couldn't make the run from the airport to the green zone, a 20-minute drive, maybe two or three turns. You couldn't make that run without casualties. Just couldn't do it. Probably the best job I had, though, was working for the NSA. That was PSD. It was moving them around in Afghanistan. I can't talk, I guess, about operational stuff or anything, but it was all, the people were more professional, the equipment we had was all state-of-the-art, you know, the communications. Oh, in Iraq, we'd get a mission brief, and the last thing the operations manager would tell us, you know, don't expect any help from Big Army, okay, probably not even medevac, they're all busy. So we'd roll out, and we'd get, I mean, people would just shoot at you as you drive by. or they'd call their friends down the street and they'd set up an IED to get you off the road and, you know, see what you got in these trucks kind of things. But in Afghanistan, it was entirely different. You know, we had a little thing we called a football, and we'd push this thing, and everybody in the country would stop what they're doing and put all their assets to our assistance. So it was a lot better. It made a lot more sense to me.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. Was the interaction with the regular army and the Marines, and how was that? But I think you kind of explained that in that last statement.
That's a good question. I mean, you know, when you're in a gunfight, nobody cares. You know, you're American, you believe in the same things. We're trying to do good, and nobody has any animosity. You know, it's just everybody just does what they were trained to do. But outside of the gunfight, there was a lot of jealousy, and they didn't like the way we were getting paid, you know, 10, 15, 20 times what they were making, doing, you know, the same stuff.
Yeah. How about the interaction with in Iraq and Afghanistan with the Iraqi soldiers, the guys that were trying to help on our side?
Yeah, actually, in Iraq, I had a lot of contact with Iraqi soldiers, the Iraqi National Guard and the Iraqi police, and those were very different entities. We had we expected that the Iraqi National Police were highly infiltrated, and the Iraqi National Guard they weren't so much infiltrated by insurgents, by people with bad intentions. I didn't have much to do with the local nationals in Afghanistan. We pretty much, you know, stayed low profile and tried to stay away.
We talked about leaving the service. Let's talk about, I guess, after you got back, you decided to become an author, and you wrote a book. A few of us in here have read the book.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice. I hope you enjoyed it.
So what possessed you to write your? I know it's a fictional book, but what possessed you to go into the writing?
There's a reason it's fiction. Yeah. Well, there's no books written about this business where the rubber meets the road. Okay, there's a handful of books that are exposés, and one over the world. Everything has a political, they have their reason for writing these books. One over the world usually, and they talk about the companies and all of this. I don't do that, and I didn't want to do that. What I wanted to do was explain to people what it was like to be out there on the road, to be an operator on the road. And the reason it's fiction is there's several reasons that it's fiction and not, you know, a memoir or whatever. The biggest one is that the CIA and the NSA had me sign the NDAs, the non-disclosure agreements, and they get the right to first look at anything I publish for the rest of my life. But they don't care about fiction. They're like, yeah, whatever. Okay, go ahead, fiction, we don't care. Okay, so now the way the book came about was after my first trip over there, the company I was working for, Custer Battles, we weren't doing anybody any good. Okay, the Kurds were, you know, after 35 years of persecution, they were all about killing Iraqis, and they didn't mind dying in the process either. So they'd get on these trucks and they'd hang out of the trucks and wave their AK-47s, and if somebody didn't move fast enough, they'd shoot them. There was a final incident with some children getting crushed underneath one of our trucks. I don't fault the guys that, you know, were in the truck. That I just don't think we should have been there. Okay, we weren't doing any good. It was brutal on the roads. It was slamming your truck into people and pushing them out of the way, into their cars and what have you. Okay, we got stuck in a traffic jam. And it was, everybody knew, you know, if we stay here for another couple minutes, we're all going to die, right? That's the way it was in Iraq in the early years. So they tried to push their way through, but the cars were backed up on each other and they couldn't get through. And the truck went up and over a sedan and crushed these kids. And that was just a few feet in front of me. Thinking about that, it's, you know, this is wrong, okay? It's not... Yeah, I came up in the Army, and I don't mind, you know, doing what needs to be done, but there has to be some sort of an ethic to it, right? And right after us, the soldiers would come through and try to win their hearts and minds, and they'd be like, get the hell out of here, you know? And so it was. I think it was contradictory to what we were trying to do in the country. And the company didn't care. They were, like I said, they were running five or six teams on a contract that called for 25 or 26 teams. All they cared about was the money, and didn't care who died. And they suppressed everything that, you know. Another thing that the operations manager would tell us is, you know, remember what happens on the road stays on the road, right? Okay? And if they get within 100 meters, shoot them. So anybody in a car that's 100 meters from us, and we shot them, specifically them, not at their car, not at the road, but shot them, then we weren't held accountable, okay? So I was angry, and I pulled the plug on that company. A bunch of us did, and I went to the company and told the company, hey, we got to do something else. And they're like, no. I'm like, okay, fine. So I left the company, and I went to the Army Criminal Investigation Division, CID, right? And they were all about it at first. They're like, oh, yeah, you know. And then after a while, I got back in touch with them. I said, well, where's this going? What's happening? And they're like, oh, we're working on it. So I'm like, okay, obviously they're not doing anything about it. So I wrote the Senate Armed Services Committee. I wrote six letters, or the same letter to six people, three Democrats, three Republicans. I figured somebody would take notice, you know, and nothing, you know, just crickets. I think one of them came back and said, oh, you got to get in touch with somebody else. And I'm like, okay, nobody wants to hear this, okay? And I went to the media. Back in the day, MSNBC put it on for two nights in a row. You know, they did all their checks and whatevers, and they talked about it for a couple of nights, but still, you know, it didn't satisfy me. Okay, this was all wrong. You know, they should have used armored vehicles so that the guys in the convoy weren't afraid as like they were. Okay, so if you're afraid, you're going to pull the trigger a lot faster, right? And if you're not afraid, you're like, yeah, whatever, you know. They could have taken that ammo in helicopters. It probably wouldn't have cost any more. Just hook it up to a Chinook and take it down there and drop it off, you know, but they didn't do that. So we were running the roads and civilians were dying. That's where it started from. That's where the book started as a letter to the CID saying this is what's going on. They didn't care. I was frustrated, so I went back. The old, you know, the only medicine for me was to go back and do it right. And I did. The companies that then I was able to select companies that were reputable. When I got there, you know, it was just years and years and years of more stories. At some point, I was trying to get a PhD because there's a lot of downtime, right? The professors at George Mason University told me that I couldn't write about Iraq. It was too soon, and that I had to let history mature for at least 30 years. And I'm like, well, what about, you know? What about primary sources? You know, they're all about primary sources if they're Roman or Greek or something, you know? So I kept getting shut down. Then I decided to put it into, I'll just write my own book and, you know, call it fiction. You know, you've been there and done that sort of thing, and you know, reading that book, that this is no joke. This isn't something that Tom Clancy dreamed up because somebody told him about it,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
This is written by somebody who was there and knows the difference. I know what fear is like when you're going through that door and there's people on the other side that want to kill you. Okay, so yeah, that's what motivated me writing the book. And I think after I came here to Fernandina, we were building a house over there and we were staying in somebody else's house, and my daughter was going to school, so I had about 4 months that I just sat there and I finished it up and wrote it. And it took me 8 days to get a publisher, which is crazy and unheard of, you know. Who gets a publisher, a major publishing house, in 8 days?
Yeah. Is there any more books in the work?
I've started one, but I really haven't sat down seriously. I stay pretty busy. We've got a couple of acres of land, and you know, while I was out there improving my fighting position, right?
So I take it Custer's no longer in business, right?
Custer Battles, yeah, they're out of business. They ended up killing a Iraqi National Guard colonel, and just the same stuff, you know, just shooting at everybody as they're driving down the road. And the American commander of that area shut him down, blacklisted him. They were friends, and he shut him down. And all their contracts went through that area, so they couldn't keep going. As a matter of fact, I was sitting in front of the embassy in Baghdad one day, and one of the guys that I used to work for with that company, or I used to work with, came up and he said, "Hey man, you guys got any jobs?" And I was like, "What happened?" And he said he was with his convoy. He was running a convoy, and they had gotten into Baghdad and doing their, they were delivering it for wherever. And he said the company called him up and told him not to come back. He said, "We got nothing for you." Just left them there in the middle of Iraq.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and not a good time. That was probably 2005 or 6, yeah. Yeah, and they just shut their doors and just cut everybody off. So I don't know how they got home.
So you brought some pictures and some other documents. I know this is a video recording, or not a video recording, just a voice recording. But do you care to talk about what you brought, the photographs a little bit? Go ahead, feel free to grab.
Well, yeah, these photographs are about, these are the book, okay? It's not a big deal. This what I use whenever somebody asks me to talk about my book. Now, if you like, you gotta read the table of contents there, because that's really good. These two endorsements right here are generals that knew me while I was doing this. This guy was a third bat sniper that I knew and worked with him on those programs. Yeah, and then Ken Tillman was a New York Times bestseller. He's the one that motivated me to actually get it published. It's just on the range in Afghanistan, Special Forces range. It was pretty cool. This is really interesting here, though, these two pictures. These are typical team pictures, right? And the first one is with Custer Battles. This was the vehicle. You can see it was hit by an IED. And the guy who was driving that was, he lost his hand. This was our only up-armored vehicle. But at an intersection, he opened a door to wave somebody by. He broke the seal, and they blew an IED into the vehicle with him, blew his hand off, and really messed him up. And then this picture here is 13 years later in Afghanistan. I was on a contract working with Patriot Group International, PGI. So three of the companies I worked for were actually one contract. So NEM had it first. They lost the contract to PGI, and EODT owned part of that contract. So PGI and EODT is when these pictures were taken. And that's why I've blocked out their faces, because they're younger. They're half my age, and they're all still working the programs.
Well, this is going to come to a close. So anyhow, I just want to say thanks for speaking to us today. And is there anything else you want to add before we end the recording? We're talking to Bill Krohn, and the book he wrote is called Working the Kill Zone. This precludes our interview. If you got anything else?
No. I mean, I got stories. I got all kinds of stories. But, I've been more gunfights than I can remember. But, yeah, that's it. I suggest reading my book. It's got several of those stories in there. It's pretty good, too, right? Keep you on the edge of your seat. Keep you turning the pages.
Absolutely. All right, Bill. Thank you very much for sharing your story. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.